From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. No word yet on whether the accuser of Judge Brett Kavanaugh will participate in Monday's scheduled Senate hearing. Bay Area professor Christine Ford's attorney had said she'd publicly testify about an alleged sexual assault by Kavanaugh. However, Senate Democrats are resisting the Monday hearing that could affect Ford's willingness to participate. We'll have the latest right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. And just tacking along with what Hetty just said, if you're observing Yom Kippur beginning at sundown tonight, we wish you a very meaningful, very significant day for you and your family members and friends who are practicing the Jewish faith. And we'll look forward to your being with us as you continue throughout the course of the week. The CEO of the nation's largest retirement system, CalPERS, doesn't have a college degree. She was hired largely based on her track record heading up the state of Washington's public employee pension fund. And she was there for many years, came up through the ranks. Later this hour, we'll look at the ways in which non-degreed employees have sometimes overcome biases against them and moved into high-level positions. But first, the Senate Judiciary Committee has announced a Monday hearing featuring Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and the woman accusing him of sexual assault, Christine Blasey Ford. However, committee Democrats are against the move. They want a full investigation of the allegations before the committee revisits Kavanaugh's nomination. They're also hoping to hold off a confirmation vote as long as possible in case Democrats take the Senate in November. With us is Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. Ron, good to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Larry.
So the last I heard, the chairman of the committee, Senator Grassley, said that Ford has not yet responded to invitations to appear on Monday. Do you have any update on that?
He says that his staffers have not heard back from her lawyer, but I think the general expectation is that while there may not have been a formal response, that she is planning to come to Washington and testify, and that we, generally speaking, still expect that to happen on Monday. Now, there are many different ways that that could come a cropper, but that is the expectation at this time.
Well, I was wondering if she is in conversations with Democrats over this, and if Democrats are resistant to holding the hearing Monday, I was wondering if she might be listening to them and then decide she's not going to participate under these terms. Do we know if she's had any contact beyond the contact that she had with her local congresswoman?
Yes, I believe she has had contact with members of the committee on the Democratic side.
Okay, so that there could be some sort of a coordination there in terms of it. Is there any talk of Democrats boycotting the Monday hearing?
Not that I know of. If there is a hearing on Monday, the general expectation is that it would feature both Dr. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee. Now, that could also be spread over 2 days. That's the way it's been done in the one really clear precedential case that we have, the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas case. But they could also appear on the same day. I would think it highly unlikely they would appear at the same time, but they could well appear on the same day. There are negotiations going on about having other witnesses. Some of the Democratic senators think that other witnesses should be called to amplify the relative stories or the related stories being told by the two principals. And that is a possibility that could take place first on Monday, and then the two principals perhaps could be heard on Tuesday. It's not clear at this point. It's very much in flux.
And I was wondering, has there been any talk that if Professor Ford declines to respond, or that she could be subpoenaed? Has there been any talk, or any of these other individuals, for example, Mark Judge, whom Professor Ford claims was in the room during this alleged attack?
That would be obviously a possibility, but I have not heard the word subpoena used by any officials or authorities up to this point.
We're talking with NPR's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent. Ron, can you give us a sense of how this has affected Capitol Hill and not just the committee, but Congress and the Senate generally?
Well, there is other business to be completed. There's an opioid bill. There are funding bills to keep the federal government open past the end of the fiscal year, which is, by the way, September 13th, just 12 days, September 30th, just 12 days away. So, yes, there is other business that should be occupying Congress, but I think it's also safe to say that this is the only issue that is preoccupying Congress.
Now, at the time of the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings before this same committee, you were working for Congressional Quarterly, I understand. So you were paying close attention to this. What parallels do you see in that process? And there's obviously the racial difference that's involved. But do you see other differences aside from that and the degree of assault that is alleged?
Well, there is certainly a great deal of difference in the degree that is alleged, because the allegations that were made by Professor Hill back in 1991 had to do with sexual harassment. They had to do with Clarence Thomas's repeated advances, his repeated attempts to date her, the way he treated her and talked to her when they were co-workers before he was a judge. So those two were years-old allegations, but they were not allegations of attempted rape. They were allegations of sexual harassment, and they were potent, and they affected many people, and many people saw in them a symbolic representation of how women are treated in the workplace generally, just in the same way that today these allegations, what is known of them to this point by Dr. Ford, are reminding people of the danger that many women feel they are in of sexual harassment to the point of actual sexual attack, assault. In this case, Dr. Ford has said she considered it an attempted rape.
We're talking with Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. You know, at the time of the Thomas Hill hearings, it seemed to me that because it was so difficult to corroborate, to determine what really happened in their exchanges, it was just sort of left for people through the prism of their own personal experiences or their political ideology to determine who they thought was telling the truth. And you know, I wonder in a case like this, where it may be very difficult, you know, unless we hear from further witnesses who come forward or any other things that we're not currently aware of, how they're possibly going to get this hearing out of that sort of prism of you know, views about politics and whether they want Kavanaugh generally confirmed.
That is obviously the background, because at this juncture, as we know, there is no clear Democratic support for him, although there could be some votes on the floor from people from states that were won in 2016 by Donald Trump and who have difficult reelection campaigns in their home states, places like Montana, North Dakota, West Virginia. And those people are going to be under a certain amount of pressure. But we don't know of any Democrats on the committee who are planning to vote for Brett Kavanaugh at this particular point. And we don't know of any Republicans who are planning to vote against him. So it's a perfect party split. It's a perfect polarized vote already. Now you bring in this issue. And this issue complicates matters not only for Republican women in the Senate, but also for Republican moderates in the Senate who feel the desire to be much more responsive, perhaps, than some of their colleagues to not only this individual case, but to the larger symbolic significance of these allegations in the Me Too moment. This is the hashtag Me Too movement that is having its influence over the attitudes of people in Congress and in the country as a whole.
Ron Elving of NPR with us. Also joining us is Paul Collins, professor and director of legal studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. Professor Collins, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's great to be on with you.
So first of all, where do you place this historically as this is playing out? And are the Thomas Hill hearings the closest parallel we would have to this?
Oh, without a doubt. Certainly the ghosts of the Hill-Thomas hearings are going to be there on Monday and perhaps for weeks to come, depending on how this all plays out. This is a very significant moment in American history in that we have a Supreme Court nominee who appeared to be on the fast track towards confirmation, facing some exceptionally serious allegations that might derail the nomination.
And if, in fact, this does play out with hearings Monday or some future date, how do you think they might be conducted differently, if at all, than the Hill-Thomas hearings of the past?
I think the number one difference that we'll probably observe is that Republicans, in particular on the committee, will be very sensitive to the way in which Professor Ford is treated. It's not unfair to say that both Democrats and Republicans on the committee 27 years ago treated Professor Hill very, very poorly. And I think that the committee is going to be very, very sensitive to not making those mistakes again.
And how this is going to be a challenge, though. How do they do that in a way that it doesn't appear to be badgering of Professor Ford, but also attempts to get at the extent of her memory of the event and her credibility?
That's going to be a challenge. Professor Hill wrote a very interesting op-ed in The New York Times this morning, discussing how it might be a good idea to have members of the Judiciary Committee undergo some type of training to approach a question like this. And I don't think that would be the worst idea in the world. It seems to me that members of the Judiciary Committee are ill-equipped for investigating an issue such as this.
Is there a challenge in doing that, though, in that the types of training that would be provided would be coming from its own particular bias towards the alleged victim in a case like this, and that could in some way not fully serve what the committee needs to do?
I think that's a good point. I think the biggest challenge that the Judiciary Committee members are going to have is making it appear that the entire investigation is not colored through some sort of partisan lens. If it looks overtly partisan, that is to say, if the Democrats look like they unanimously believe Professor Ford and the Republicans look like they unanimously believe Judge Kavanaugh, that's going to be a real problem for the American public. And I think it'll leave open these questions as to what the truth is for decades to come.
President Trump just commented in an informal news briefing saying he does not think the FBI should be involved in investigating the allegation against Judge Brett Kavanaugh. President Trump saying he does not think that the FBI should do that. There's some additional comments, and we'll share those with you shortly. We're talking with Paul Collins, professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's in both the political science, legal department there as well. Also with us, professor at the City University of New York School of Law, Merrick Rosain. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So your sense of the challenge that exists for all the parties if this hearing comes together?
Well, I think the committee needs to decide what is their standard that they're going to apply in terms of this review. Normally in a criminal proceeding, of course, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. But here you're talking about the appointment, a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court in a very divided court. And if there is any question of somebody's past activity, I think it should tilt in favor of not confirming that individual. So I think one of the things we've learned from the Me Too movement is women's voices and their credibility has been heightened, certainly based on past experience, certainly based on the Hill-Thomas hearings. And I think so far from what I've seen, Professor Ford has presented a very strong case that she should be believed.
And what is the how do you make that judgment?
I make that judgment because a number of years ago, according to what I've read, in therapy where she was seeking some psychological help, she mentioned this incident. This was 4 or 5 years ago. And she even used the judge's name, Kavanaugh's name. She also mentioned it to her husband. There were no, as far as I know, contemporaneous reports when she was a 15-year-old high school student who allegedly was sexually assaulted and it was an attempted rape. But in terms of her credibility, I would listen very carefully to the fact that she, in seeking therapy and seeking some emotional support for whatever was going on, let this person know that this had occurred in her life. She let her husband know that this had occurred in her life. To me, that's very credible.
We're talking with Professor Merrick Rosain, City University of New York School of Law. We have an additional guest who'll be joining us to talk about the whole confirmation process, Carolyn Shapiro of the Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director at the Chicago Kent College of Law. I welcome your calls. I'd like to hear from you. How do you think the Senate Judiciary Committee should now handle this? What are the ways to attempt to get at whether the incident occurred, the way in which it should be handled? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on AirTalk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the scheduled Monday hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh is expected to attend if the event takes place. And the woman who's accused him of sexual assault when they were both in high school, Professor Ford, also invited to attend. There is no confirmation yet that she has agreed to be there. Her attorney had earlier said that she would publicly testify about this. But since that time, Democrats have come out against the timing of the Monday hearing, saying that there should be a thorough investigation done independently of the allegations before the principals end up in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And at this point, the chair of the committee, Charles Grassley, has not indicated he intends to put this off or that there will be any formal effort to have an investigation independent of what the Judiciary Committee is planning. If you were on the Senate Judiciary Committee, what would you do? How would you handle this? 866-893-KPECC. RTB writes on the AirTalk page, this is a carefully planned event, like the protests in the chamber, by the Dems to derail Kavanaugh and save, puts in quotation, abortion. Let's say a drunken Kavanaugh actually did this in high school, yet throughout college and his entire career since, he has led a perfectly respectable life. Dozens of women will attest to this. Is this one event worthy of sinking Kavanaugh? Should crimes all be life sentences? Is there no chance that adolescent behavior can ever be overcome, but sets your future forever? The challenge to that is, and there are multiple, but one is Kavanaugh himself has denied the event. This is not a case where he's come forward and said, yes, I recognize this event. It's a terrible thing that I did. It was horrible. And I would ask you to look at the rest of my life since this episode, which was, a single terrible incident. That's not how he's characterized, said it's absolutely untrue. And according to, I believe, it was Senator Orrin Hatch, Kavanaugh had
told him, according to Hatch, that he thinks it's a case of mistaken identity, that Professor Ford is thinking of someone else who did this to her and not Kavanaugh. All right. Let me continue with Carolyn Shapiro, who is Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Institute on the Supreme Court at Chicago Kent College of Law. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
As you look at this process at this point, given that we don't have a lot of historic precedent here, how do you think the Judiciary Committee is going to have to work this through? Because it kind of seems like they're making it up as they go along right now.
Well, they are making it up as they go along, which is unfortunate because they could do the kind of background investigation that you mentioned slightly earlier. And in fact, I believe Professor Anita Hill suggested that in her New York Times piece this morning as well. And that really makes a lot more sense than trying to have people come in and testify before the committee under, you know, essentially testifying in front of millions of Americans at the same time without really any background information provided to the senators. And frankly, I think the senators would do well to consider having a professional counsel do the questioning at the hearing itself rather than they're doing it. That would, at least to some extent, depoliticize the discussion of, you know, trying to figure out what the truth of the matter is.
That's an interesting idea. So that professional counsel, what kind of experience would those individuals have?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways that could be arranged, and certainly it would be preferable to have somebody who is or have more than one somebody who is respected, a respected professional on both sides, and who is not necessarily out to prove one side or the other, or perhaps to have, you know, two different counsel asking questions, but rather than having senators who have their own political agendas and their own political concerns asking the questions. If the issue is, do we want to find out what happened, or do we want to, you know, get to a point where we're reasonably, you know, we have a general sense of what happened beyond what we already know, having the senators ask the questions doesn't seem to me to be the best way to achieve that.
Do you see any way of getting this out of a partisan framework, independent of additional corroborating information that would push this one way or the other from where it is right now?
Well, it's hard to see how it's going to really move out of a partisan framework. But the senators, and I think this is really true more of senators who aren't on the committee than senators who are, what they have to think about is what do they want to do with uncertainty? And this really goes back to what the other panel members were saying. Assuming that we can't know for sure whether Kavanaugh is telling the truth when he denies it ever happened, or and that there's going to be, you know, different people are going to feel that there are different levels of uncertainty. What do we do with that? I tend to come out on the side of Professor Hussein, that there is no entitlement to a Supreme Court seat, that this is not a criminal proceeding, that the burden of proof shouldn't necessarily have to be terribly high in order to say, no, this person shouldn't be on the Supreme Court with a lifetime appointment. But it shouldn't be zero. The allegations need to have some level of credibility, as they appear to do, to be clear. And the senators are really going to have to grapple with what to do with that. And it's not going to be an on-off switch. Yes, it's true. No, it's not true.
How are you concerned, though, that precedent could open up the door for people who are, you know, have a political axe to grind? I'm certainly not making that allegation in this case, but looking at this instance, if without further corroboration, this ends up undoing the Kavanaugh nomination, do you have any concerns that this could lead to allegations in the future that might have a specific, you know, political intent and that also would be in the difficult to corroborate and that might not have happened?
I'm not overly concerned about that. I mean, there are certainly allegations of sexual assault are overwhelmingly found to be true. False allegations are very unusual. And of course, there is no evidence here of a political motive. But the one way of addressing that it would have been to have these the allegations investigated discreetly by the FBI or by Senate Judiciary Committee investigators early on in the process. And then the members of the committee would be in a much better position to make a judgment about whether how credible they are, whether it's something that should be discussed in the executive session, or we wouldn't have necessarily have the spectacle we currently have.
All right. Again, our phone lines are open for you to weigh in on the case of the allegation against Judge Brett Kavanaugh by Bay Area College professor Christine Blasey Ford, that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her, attempted to rape her when she was 15 and Kavanaugh would have been 17. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I look forward to hearing your thoughts about this. Andy in Long Beach says, I think we should have a complete and thorough vetting and hearing. This should not be yet another repeat of the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearing. Carolyn Shapiro, do you think that this might end up going down the same road as the Hill Thomas hearings?
Well, it depends a little bit on what you mean by the same road, but certainly in terms of a public spectacle in which people don't necessarily acquit themselves terribly well. Yeah, I think that there is a real danger of that. And I hope that the rush that Senator Grassley and Senator McConnell seem to be in is really contributing to that risk. This to do this right, to think thoughtfully about how to handle this, it needs to be done deliberately and slowly and with professional investigators who don't have a political axe to grind.
All right. Let me go back to Phil Collins, Paul Collins, excuse me, professor and director of legal studies at University of Massachusetts Amherst. You've written a book about the confirmation hearings, constitutional change. What, if any, changes did the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings bring to the Senate Judiciary hearing and to confirmation hearings? Did it have any lasting effect?
Yeah. So I think the biggest change with regard to the Thomas Hill hearings is that we now have four female members of the Judiciary Committee for the first time in American history. That's going to be one of the biggest differences from what we see on Monday. Of course, when Professor Hill faced the committee, she was facing a committee made up of all white men. The committee isn't nearly as diverse as it possibly could be today, but I think it'll be a big difference having four female members on the Judiciary Committee. I think it'll give a different tenor to the hearings themselves.
This, of course, if the hearing takes place, would be nationally televised. We'd be bringing it to you live and in its entirety here on 89.3 KPCC should the Monday hearing go off as scheduled. What effect do you think this might have on conversations about it? I mean, I have to just say for myself, as you know, in the past 48 hours, as this has all sort of been steeping, I've been hearing from people, and you know, everybody rushes to judgment about who they think is telling the truth, and everything that I hear from the people I know is based on their partisan view of the world, and it seems very difficult for people to be neutral. And to just live with the fact we don't know what happened. How do you see this affecting public views of the event, Professor?
I think you're exactly right that one's partisanship is going to play a major role in coloring how we evaluate this process. It's unfortunate. I think Professor Shapiro made an excellent point that having some type of professional counsel questioning the witnesses, having the FBI conduct an investigation would be very healthy to this process, because it's going to be exceptionally difficult for the senators to make this process appear anything other than some type of a partisan show. In fact, I think what it would take to look like a legitimate process would be for opposite party senators, that is those who aren't very likely to support Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation, to step away from their party and look at things a little bit differently.
This just reminds me again how psychologically we abhor a knowledge vacuum. We rush to fill it to decide who's telling the truth, who's not. And even though we really don't have an effective way at this point to determine the reality of it and you know, try and close that gap. I want to thank you all for being with us and providing your observations and expertise. Paul Collins, University of Massachusetts Amherst, Merrick Rosain, City University of New York School of Law, and Carolyn Shapiro, Chicago Kent College of Law. Once again, we will have it for you in its entirety should the confirmation hearing take place Monday or at any time as is currently scheduled. We'll bring it to you live here on 89.3. Coming up, how do outliers, those folks who are in very high-level positions, typically calling for a college degree, how do those without it navigate that path? We'll open up the phones and talk about it. First, a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Coming up in our second hour, the raucous and brief history of the United States Football League. Back in the mid-80s, the USFL had franchises like the Los Angeles Express across the country and all sorts of wild behavior, crazy owners who couldn't meet their payroll or even pay for the buses to take players from the field to the airport. We'll hear about that history with writer Jeff Perlman, his book Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. But first, we turn our attention to the case of CalPERS Chief Executive Officer Marcy Frost, who does not have a college degree. Now, the CalPERS board, when they hired her, were fully aware of that. She'd had a very successful run leading Washington State's public employee pension program, and she'd moved up through the ranks over the years there. Now, there's a blogger who is questioning how the educational level of Marcy Frost was depicted. I'm less interested in that, but I'm interested in the case of someone who doesn't have a college degree and reaches a very high level in this case, the largest pension fund in the entire country. Now, she doesn't make the decisions about which investments to pursue and, you know, where to put their money. There is a chief investment officer who does that, but she runs CalPERS. And I'm curious if you have an example of someone else, maybe you yourself, someone in your life, who is in a high-level position that would typically have a college degree along with it and doesn't have a degree, is a non-degreed person. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. If you, the family member or friend or coworker, did it, how did you navigate a system where people in very high-level companies typically have at least a bachelor's degree, if not a higher degree than that? 866-893-KPECC. I was thinking of this in the case of a good friend of mine who has a very high level in a public agency, doesn't have a college degree, but is brilliant, very accomplished. And I can't imagine this even comes up as an issue in the workplace for my friend. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. With us is Elena Botello, who is a partner at GH Smart, a Chicago-based consulting firm that helps CEOs, boards, and investors. She's co-author of The CEO Next Door, The Four Behaviors That Transform Ordinary People into World-Class Leaders. Ms. Botello, thank you for being with us.
Larry, thank you for having me.
So how common is this to have, again, a typical degreed position like this with someone who's in that position just because they're so good at the job, you know, prove themselves and people overlook the lack of a degree?
So, Larry, actually much more common than many of us would think. So when we did the research for our for the CEO Next Door, we've analyzed 18,000 leaders that our firm has had an opportunity to assess. And we particularly looked at CEOs because, look, let's face it, CEOs are people that many of us refer to as kind of by many measures, most achieved in business, right? Here's an interesting statistics for your listeners. About 8% of CEOs in our sample did not graduate from college. 8%.
Wow, that's much higher than I would have expected.
Exactly. And it's interesting because you've talked about outliers. You know, what we all imagine a CEO looks like, right, is often very pedigreed, you know, larger-than-life human. Well, it's interesting. So 8% of our sample didn't graduate from college. 7%, only 7%, graduated from Ivy League school. And then, as you could imagine, there's a normal distribution of folks of all sorts of backgrounds in that sample. And so it's still not the rule, certainly, right? But 8% is a lot more than what you'd expect.
All right. Let's talk with Hayden in Palm Springs. So, Hayden, what's your experience with a non-degreed person holding a very high-level, typically degree job?
My dad is the administrator for several medical he's the administrator for several offices of one large medical practice, and he manages several hundred employees, and he has a lot of responsibilities for someone without a college degree. I mean, he had 12 years of junior college as he meandered a little bit, but he worked pretty hard. He kept his nose to the grindstone, and he managed to make his way to the top dog position, if you will. But I don't know how feasible that would be anymore.
Yeah. My mother was one of the first women to become management level with the old Pacific Telephone, which is now AT&T. She didn't have a college degree, but it was all her other attributes that caused her to rise so quickly, starting as service representative and moving up in the company. I think that's extremely difficult to do today. We're just sort of sheer ability, you know, you're able to move up like that. But I guess it's more common than I thought, given what we're hearing from Elena Botello. Hayden, thanks so much for sharing your father's experience. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. John in North Hollywood, what's your experience with this?
Just that I have a job that I don't have a college degree and I've, you know, said what I needed to say to get my current job, and I feel fine about it. I feel that I have a right to support my family and do what I need to do to make money in a 100%, you know, legal way, and that I'm doing that without a college degree.
So you're in sales, I understand. And I wonder if sales is a little bit different, because there it's clearly measurable. If you're a talented salesperson and that trumps everything else, what do you think?
No, absolutely. I will say that sales is definitely a place where you're able to do something like this, but it also depends on what the job is. I will tell you that the current job I'm at did ask me, I did provide, you know, that I went to school and maybe embellished a little bit as far as that goes. But as far as getting the job done, being able to complete the task and doing everything to my best ability, I have been one of the top salesmen in my company for the last 3 years.
John, congratulations. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Frank in the city of Orange says, the two most successful people I know never went to college. One, my son-in-law, who's a multimillionaire after working for major tech companies. He's currently at Amazon. Another, an old friend of mine who made a fortune as a day trader when he knew nothing about stocks. He said college teaches you to work for someone else. That was the key for him. That's Frank in the city of Orange. John in Rancho Palos Verdes, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, my cousin is the youngest executive for J.P. Morgan Chase, and he does not have a college degree. In fact, he was going for an architect degree, and he was lucky enough to kind of be picked or handpicked by an executive, and he kind of they took him under his wing, and he, you know, he's now the youngest J.P. Morgan executive, I think, in history.
Do you know if his non-degreed status ever comes up, or does, you know, who he is, his ability sort of overwhelm, not even raise that as an issue?
You know what? In the beginning, it was. He kind of felt guilty because a lot of his friends that were, you know, in places that I guess that were higher than him, you know, they were a little envious But he really, you know, he really said, you know what, in the end of the day, it's about performance and about getting the job done efficiently. And, you know, he has an incredible talent and focus for that.
John, thank you. Appreciate your sharing it. Jack in Zurich writes on the page, do you need a degree for some jobs where most have them? No. Entertainment company CEO, not required. CalPERS, not required. The person's good at what they do. Brain surgeon, yes. architect, civil engineer, yes, yes. If she, meaning the CalPERS CEO, is good at what she does, by all accounts she is, I have no problem with it. That's Jack in Zurich. Again, you can share your comment on the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. Sam in Claremont said, my mother's brother started as a small teller at a bank, grew up to become a bank manager, was so highly respected, they brought him up to the corporate level to train new managers. He only had a high school diploma, but because he was so good at his job, he advanced. 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. I just got a blast from the Wall Street Journal. Tesla, according to the Journal, says the Department of Justice has opened a criminal probe related to Elon Musk's tweet that he secured funding to take Tesla private. So that just breaking news. We've only seen that from the Wall Street Journal. I haven't seen that directly from Tesla. We'll check on that, of course. Right now, our focus is on individuals who don't have a college degree but are in positions that you'd be surprised to have someone there without a degree. This rises from the hiring of the nation's largest public pension fund, CalPERS, here, the California Public Employee Retirement System. The woman who was hired for the CEO job came from the state of Washington's public employee retirement system. She'd been there for many years, moved up through the ranks, headed that organization. CalPERS hired her all without a college degree. And the question is, you know, what does it take for someone to be able to get past what typically is a limitation of not having a degree? Elena Botello of GH Smart, based in Chicago. Just briefly, what are the ways in which someone can sort of inoculate against or be able to sidestep being non-degreed?
Yeah, absolutely. So in our analysis, we found successful individuals practice four leadership behaviors we talk about in our book, and they make particular career choices that help them get to the top even without pedigree, whether they had no degree at all. And so, for example, one of the things we've noticed is that, and it actually resonates with some of the things we heard from your listeners just now, and probably with Marcy's story, right, is they over-index on results. They tend to be in roles. They often take on roles where results are really measurable. So more than half of the CEOs who got to the top without a college degree, 56% of them came through the sales and marketing track, for example. They also tend to start at the bottom. They really know the industry. They really know the company. So you gave an example with Marcy. She ran Washington State. And so they're able to be judged by their results and by their experience, not so much by their resume.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Matthew in North Hollywood. Good to have you with us. What's your experience in this?
Hey, Larry. I'm currently the director of camp programming for a nonprofit here in Los Angeles called Street Poets. I've obtained this position by working over a decade in this field, teaching in various juvenile detention facilities and creating curriculum. And I don't have a college degree.
And, yeah. Is there any impediment in that? Do you feel like people at all consider you differently?
Yeah, I think during like my time in trying to, you know, build up in various nonprofits, it's just been an overarching theme of like, do you have the ability to do the things that people with college degrees would so-called be easily able to do or obtain? And it just seemed a lot of like language. There were just language barriers in how communication is done that would just like make me feel obscure or try to single me out for not having a college degree.
Do they have any question about your ability to, you know, commit to something? One of the things I hear a lot about, you know, is, well, you know, it's not so much what someone learns in college that's the critical issue, but it shows you've gotten through the 4-year process and been able to be committed and to do something that has challenges along the way. I mean, is that something that you think factors into any negative view people would have of your experience?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, like, there were direct quotes of saying, like, well, you know, there will have a certain expectation and work hours and work ethic. And I feel like that's insulting to a certain degree. You know, in my field specifically, like, it's an artistic field, and it's something that I personally have branded myself in and branded my own work in. So it's a little different than, say, a regular job, but I feel that, you know, it does question someone's work ethic and integrity. I mean,
yeah.
I felt very taken aback in the times that it's come at me, for sure.
Matthew, I really appreciate you sharing your experience. Thanks. And I think what it fails to take into account, that the sort of perception that you're talking about, Matthew, is that, you know, for some people, going through 4 years of college is challenging, but, you know, completely doable. For other people, college, the way that they learn, college is just a very bad fit. They learn in very different kinds of ways, experientially, tactfully, what have you, and that college is just not a good fit, despite high intelligence, very strong work ethic, and on multiple skills. Let's talk with Qua in Long Beach. Qua, what's your experience with this?
Hey, Larry. Actually, I'm calling in for my girlfriend. She doesn't have a college degree, and she's actually a director of marketing for a publicly traded shoe company.
Wow.
She's been with this position for about a year now.
And has she felt that lacking the degree has been any hindrance to her?
No, not at all. Her employers were well aware of that when they hired her. But I think it was more of her experience, you know, with social media platforms.
Yeah. Again, she could really demonstrate what she's done. It's creative, you know, marketing, of course, and so she'd have all that she could draw on in making her case for the job. When, you know, sometimes other positions, like straight management level positions that are squishier to judge, the college degree sort of becomes the filter. Elena, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think anyone in California in particular, right, you're in good company. So the famous college dropouts, right, Bill Gates, Michael Dell, Steve Jobs, they've all started hugely successful companies. We actually found that founders, the folks who didn't go to college are twice as likely to be founders in how they advance to the top, which goes exactly to what you described, Larry. They could be terrifically successful and very, very smart, but may not necessarily fit into the mold. You also actually see a trend, I think, if we have this conversation 5 years from now, it might be a very different conversation, because over 15 companies now, companies like Google, Apple, IBM, Hilton, Costco, they are actively recruiting for positions that are really highly expert positions. Apple, for example, has a position of genius that is specifically open to non-college graduates, and they will train individuals in those skills. And so there are actually new paths opening up for folks where college may not be the right
thing. That's great. I'm glad to hear that. Let me share some more listener comments. Sally in Venice says, I run a very successful company. I have no degree. I left school when I was 15, started from the bottom in the entertainment industry 25 years ago, became a producer, then started my own commercial entertainment company. Ray in Santa Monica says, I have an advanced degree, but most of my friends didn't go to college. They're pretty successful. I'm in fine arts. I don't think a degree matters much in my industry. Matt in Glendale says, a huge factor of this 8% is these individuals might be more entrepreneurial. They can think on their feet. Peter in Upland says, I don't have a degree. Worked with a company for 20 years, starting from the bottom. Got pretty high there. There was change in the presidency. They decided they needed someone with a degree. So I was reorganized down, even though I had all this experience. That's a kick in the gut, Peter. And Mark in Long Beach says, I don't have a degree. I've been in my industry for 40-plus years, received a high rank in international company because I never turned down an assignment. Now I'm a mentor, and I think crucial to have a college degree. I'd get one if I did it again. That's Mark in Long Beach. Thank you so much for joining us this hour of Air Talk. More to come.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by October 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Coming up a little later this hour, a couple of kind of fun segments. One, we're going to look at the explosion in bubbly water that's out there. Call it seltzer water, sparkling water, whatever you want to call it. It is booming as fewer Americans drink traditional soda drinks and are looking for different ways of variety in water. We'll talk about the water wars. Not pulling it out of the ground or getting it to Southern California, but on the shelves of supermarkets. That's later this hour. And then look at the history of the Wild and Woolly United States Football League. It was around for a couple of years in the mid-'80s. And you think the Oakland Raiders of the NFL had a wild history, and they did. This is a whole other game in the USFL. But first, we turn our attention to a couple of factors in the fast food industry, a couple of stories. First of all, yesterday, a lawsuit was filed in federal court by the U.S. Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, the EEOC, alleging sexual harassment at a Del Taco franchise in Rancho Cucamonga. The allegations go back to earlier this year and previous to that. Just a few months ago, a woman employee of that Del Taco came forward, reported harassment to Human Resources, the EEOC, and a Del Taco hotline. And from there, the EEOC moved on to investigate the allegations. There also is scheduled today in cities across the country selected walkouts by employees of McDonald's restaurants. One of the franchises here in Southern California is in South Los Angeles on Florence, just west of the Harbor Freeway. And in about an hour, the employees there were told will walk off the job to protest McDonald's handling of sexual harassment allegations. My question for you in this next segment of Air Talk is if you have worked in the fast food industry, either currently or in the past, and you've experienced sexual harassment, I'd be interested in hearing how it was dealt with effectively or not. If you have been in management of a fast food location or the owner of a franchise, I'd like to hear your experience of dealing with this. What you know is alleged in the fast food field is that often employees, because of their relative youth, because of their comparative lack of economic clout, often find it more difficult to have allegations of sexual harassment taken seriously, having them fully investigated, and any necessary disciplinary or policy action taken as a result of that. First, to talk with us about how this plays out in the fast food industry is Robin DiPietro, who is the professor of hotel, restaurant, and tourism management at the University of South Carolina. She teaches courses on restaurant management and franchising. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, what is the relationship between these big fast food corporations and their franchisee? How much control do the companies have?
Well, basically, a franchise is set up that the franchisee purchases the right for a certain amount of time to use the name brand, the menu, the operations procedures from the franchisor headquarters. And they the franchisor headquarters, when they get into this arrangement, definitely state to franchisees that it's their responsibility to follow the letter of the law. And the franchisors do not get involved in personnel decisions, but they do provide the franchisee with training and proper manuals to ensure that the franchisees are given correct information. But in effect, they're basically independent. Franchisees are basically independent contractors, and there's no really employee-employer relationship with that corporate headquarters. So
okay.
It really is up to the individual franchisee to ensure that they're following the letter of the law when it comes to personnel decisions, HR complaints, sexual harassment complaints, and not the corporate franchisor responsibility.
I don't know what the model is in the fast food industry, but I know in some of the restaurant industry where you've got these franchised restaurants, mm-hmm. that you've got some huge franchise groups. I mean, they're companies in and of themselves that own large numbers of a particular franchise, and they hold great sway within the larger company because they have so many of the restaurants. And then you may have others that's like, you know, a standalone restaurant owned by a family. And does that play out into how effectively they handle some of these HR issues?
I think that definitely is a factor. I think the single unit operators, the franchisee that owns one McDonald's or one Dunkin' Donuts, is at a little bit of a disadvantage because they don't have the money, they don't make the money to be able to support an entire HR department or even an HR specific person to work with them. But they do have guidelines that they know they need to follow. And typically those single unit operators have the owner and or management deal with any HR issues and complaints. And then the larger operators, like you talked about, the franchisees who maybe own 100 specific restaurants, they have a lot more financial clout and they're able to hire human resource departments and human resource people to work with them, but either way, it's made very clear to all franchisees that this is part of their responsibility as a franchisee. But you're right; I mean, the finances are very different between those two types of restaurant groups.
We're talking with Robin DiPietro, who's at the University of South Carolina, where she teaches hotel restaurant tourism management. And she spent 20 years working at a Burger King franchise group that had multiple locations in the Midwest. Also with us is Kate Bischoff, who owns Thrive Law and Consulting, which consults with companies on employment and HR law. Ms. Bischoff, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the potential responsibility here of the larger company? I mean, these specific actions, Del Taco is being cited in the EEOC federal lawsuit. McDonald's Corporation is being cited in the walkout today. How much legal exposure do the large corporations have versus the franchises?
It's probably going to be pretty minimal. Both organizations like Del Taco and other franchisors make very clear to the franchisees, the restaurant owners and operators themselves, that they are at arm's length. They make sure that while they may be giving sample manuals, they might be giving direction about logo and branding and all that kind of advice, they make sure that the owners and the operators understand that they are responsible for the day-to-day management of the actual building, including the hiring and firing decisions that are made. What the big guys, the Del Taco, the big brands, they're looking to make sure that customers receive this virtually similar service and product that they would get in any Del Taco that they go to any McDonald's that they go to, because that's what we rely on when we're customers. but the actual decisions and the operations and the people there and how those people conduct themselves are really the operator's responsibility.
If
the EEOC is going to try to say that they are joint employers, but that's a tough argument for the EEOC to make.
Yeah, and I wonder, though, if you've got multiple complaints that are made. Let's say you've got a particular restaurant, a franchise-operated restaurant. You've got the staff there or an attorney for staff members there, making consistent complaints to the franchisor, to the large, company whose name we know, and they don't really do much to follow up. Is there potential civil liability there, or do you think they can just cite this arm's length distance with the franchisee?
Well, it depends. In some states, there are aiding and abetting laws where if an organization knows that harassment or discrimination is occurring and they turn a blind eye, it's possible under aiding and abetting laws that the big guys then could be held liable in some way, shape, or form. However, Title VII doesn't have that. When Congress made the law, it was very specific that it didn't include the aiding and abetting portion. So while the EEOC is going to be arguing that the Del Tacos and the McDonald's really have their fingers in the day-to-day operations so that they are a joint employer, it's going to be difficult to hold them liable on their own.
Let's talk with Tina in Pasadena. Tina, I understand you own a franchise. What's your experience with this?
We were sued by an employee who said that she had experienced sexual harassment. We were never informed until the lawyer sent us a letter. So had we been made aware of that, we have many provisions in place. We take that issue very seriously. We have training and would never have tolerated anything about what she alleged. But we were never given an opportunity to address the issue and went straight to an attorney.
Do you have one location or multiple restaurants?
We have multiple locations.
Okay. And do you have a dedicated HR person to field a complaint like that, or would it have to go through the employee's manager?
It generally goes through the manager, but I have, as the owner, I have my personal phone number in the employee handbook, on the wall. In case there's an issue, someone can come directly to me.
Okay. But it sounds like that has not happened. You haven't had that experience?
We have had other employees reach out and say they were uncomfortable due to other, situations. They felt uncomfortable based on personality conflicts, but this was the only time that anybody had ever made this type of an allegation, and we had no opportunity to correct it.
Hmm. And is there any interaction that you have with the franchisor, the company that you represent, with the local restaurant over these kinds of employment issues?
No, they do not want to be involved in any sort of situation that we would have. We actually had an employee of the franchise who was coming into our locations, and we had employees say that he was making them uncomfortable. And so we told the employees he's no longer allowed in the store. We told the franchise, and the franchise either dismissed him or he left on his own, but he was no longer working for the franchise.
And they felt uncomfortable because of they felt harassed or overly scrutinized. What did they say about the person?
He said that they felt sexually harassed by him.
Sexually harassed. Okay. All right. So, Tina, what do you think of the McDonald's walkout, the EEOC lawsuit against Del Taco? Or do you have any concerns about how this could affect those of you who have franchises?
I think that people who knowingly allow this to go on, and I read briefly in the newspaper today, the company, and I'm assuming it's a franchise, was made aware by the employees through their HR. The managers were made aware, and then the EEOC contacts you as the owner of the company directly. So they had multiple opportunities to correct this behavior, and they chose not to. So I'm not in that position. I take these issues very seriously as a woman and as a business owner. But unfortunately, the way California law works is I'm liable regardless of all the safeguards I take.
Tina, I appreciate your call. Thank you. Tina in Pasadena, who's an owner of multiple restaurant franchises. Kate Bischoff, who's employment law expert of Thrive Law and Consulting. Your thoughts about what Tina described?
I think Tina is handling it exactly correct. When you get a complaint of sexual harassment, you need to take that seriously. And she's right that most franchisors are not going to be involved in those decisions and certainly don't want to be involved in what happens if there is a complaint.
Again, I'd love to hear from you. If you have worked in the fast food industry or currently work in the industry, you've had experience of being sexually harassed or witnessed it. How did this play out in your workplace? If you have been a manager of a fast food location or you are a franchisee that has one or more restaurants, I'd be interested in hearing, as Tina just described her personal experience, I'd be interested in hearing yours. We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back to Robin DiPietro, University of South Carolina, where she teaches hotel, restaurant, and tourism management. Do you generally see, in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, this issue of sex harassment being taken much more seriously in the hospitality biz?
I think it's definitely brought a light on a subject that oftentimes isn't discussed or you try not to mention it. But it's brought a light on the subject, and I think that a lot more people are recognizing maybe what the issue is. And it's interesting with the hashtag MeToo movement. I mean, you can see that sexual harassment happens at all walks of life, and whether you're educated or not educated, wealthy or not wealthy, it's not a fast food restaurant issue. It's an issue that's prevalent throughout society. And so, yeah, I hope that we see more people standing up for it. But, in this situation, I think it's important to note that what your speaker said before about she addresses these issues, takes them on a case-by-case basis. I think that all franchisees need to be doing that, because one bad apple or two bad apples could really stain the reputation of an entire restaurant company or an entire industry. And I think it's important that we don't sweep it under the rug, but also that we recognize that certain franchisees need to be taking more responsibility.
Thank you both so much for being with us. That's Professor Robin DiPietro, University of South Carolina. For 20 years, she worked with the Burger King franchise group that had a number of locations in the Midwest. She now teaches this to her students as a professor, University of South Carolina. My thanks to Kate Bischoff, whose firm is Thrive Law and Consulting, specializing in working with employers in adhering to employment law and with HR matters. You can share your comments about the fast food industry and its issues with sexual harassment on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, it's anything but fizzling, the bubbly water business, flavored water, extra vitamins and minerals, all kinds of different sources for the bubbles in the water. We'll talk about the explosion in the industry in 1 minute. You can call it seltzer, sparkling water, club soda, whatever name you want to put to it. And yes, there are some subtle differences. It is an exploding field. The soft drink business is having a very tough time. And so some of the biggest companies, like Coca-Cola, are looking for alternative ways of getting consumers to buy specialty drinks. So they're looking at specially flavored sparkling waters, waters that they're touted for coming from particular sources, that have particular fortifiers, whether it's caffeine or vitamins that are included in it. With us to talk about the trend and whether consumers are drinking up is Gary Hemphill of the Beverage Marketing Corporation. It's an independent consulting firm. He's managing director of research. Gary, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Good morning.
So how are these various bubble waters playing out in the market? Are they helping to make up for the decline in traditional sodas?
Well, it's interesting because, water as a whole has been growing for many, many years. And in fact, if you look at the overall marketplace, people drink more bottled water today in aggregate, including sparkling and still, than they do carbonated soft drinks. So this trend really isn't new. It's been one that's fairly ongoing. But I'd say in the last 5 years or so, sparkling water has caught fire. And there's different versions of it. There's seltzer. You really could drink club soda. There's imports. There's domestic brands. So there's a wide variety of brands. But when you look at that whole area, you see huge, huge growth in sparkling water. And I think the bottom line reason for that is that people still like their bubbles. They still like carbonation, though they want it in a little bit more healthier format.
One of the things I find fascinating is the example of LaCroix, which has, instead of flavoring, it's scented water that sort of fools you into thinking it's flavored. Is that how that one works, Gary?
Well, it does have an essence of flavoring.
It does. Okay. All right.
Over there. Yeah, exactly. I think to me, the most interesting thing about LaCroix is that it's an overnight success that was actually introduced in, I think, 1981 or something like that. So it's a brand that's been around for a long time, but sometimes it's about doing a good job with a product that's and also being in the right place at the right time. So they were there, ready to go. National Beverage Corporation owns the brand, and they've done a terrific job with it. But the timing is also helpful because the category as a whole, you know, as I mentioned, is really caught fire.
Also with us is Caleb Bryant, Senior Beverage Analyst at Mintel, global market research firm. Caleb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
What do you see as the future of these? You think that we're looking at a fad, or might it have more staying power?
I definitely think it has a lot of staying power. The sparkling water category, while it certainly is growing, 85% of bottled water sold is still water. So still a lot of room of growth. Primarily, we see consumers who are purchasing these sparkling waters. They tend to be younger. The younger millennials or the Gen Z consumers. Definitely a big opportunity to for these brands to engage with new audiences, older consumers, things like that.
Love to hear from listeners if you've made the switch away from traditional soft drinks to bubbling water, what the reasons behind that are, what you look for in that. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Caleb, one of the things that's kind of interesting is even sort of old line water brands, like we have Arrowhead here in Southern California and Crystal Geyser, you know, some of these others that have their typical still water are adding bubbles to it as well. And I wonder if that, if from a marketing standpoint, more of a challenge where you kind of confuse the customer versus like LaCroix, you've got, you know, a dedicated name for a brand and all of it is carbonated water.
Yeah, I think that all these different beverages, these companies, they really see the opportunity with sparkling. Now everything is sparkling. Things like highball energy drinks, it's a sparkling water with caffeine. There was Anheuser-Busch's first non-alcoholic acquisition. So even these alcohol brands are seeing opportunity with sparkling water. Even things like we see sparkling coffees mixed with juice. And things like PepsiCo acquiring SodaStream, targeting consumers who don't even want to purchase cans of sparkling soda. They want to make it at home for themselves.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm also curious because much of course, what drives the carbonated water or sparkling water category is you're talking about the mouthfeel of it, the texture of the water. That's much of the appeal. And I wonder for those of you that are connoisseurs, maybe you drink a variety of different brands or you've tried several different brands. What are some of the differences, or is carbonation just carbonation? 866-893-KPECC. Gary Hempel, can you speak to that issue? Are there significant difference in the characteristics of the bubbles from brand to brand?
Well, there are differences. There's the differences in the carbonation levels. So some brands are more highly carbonated. Some brands are a little bit less so. So it definitely has a variance.
Okay. And of course, there are flavor differences above and beyond texture, of course. You know, I had always assumed that seltzer water and club soda were essentially the same. I didn't realize that they were actually different because club soda has a particular additive for taste. And Gary, can you talk a little bit about the different categories in sparkling beverages?
Sure.
The way we would look at the marketplace, you have traditional sparkling water, and that would be like Crystal Geyser, which you mentioned. In the Northeast, Poland Spring has a sparkling version. You also have imported brands. So you have Perrier and San Pellegrino.
But those two don't have their carbonation's natural, isn't it?
Correct. So that would be the difference, I would say, between a sparkling water. Often the carbonation is natural, coming from the source, coming from the spring, to something more like a seltzer water where the carbonation is added. So that's really the only difference, the primary difference between those two in terms of manufacturing. But the lay of the land is basically sparkling water, seltzer water, club soda, and I guess if you want, you could throw tonic water in there too, though it has a pretty.
That's a pretty sweet. Yeah, I would say that's almost sort of a toad. But club soda, you don't pick up on the sweetness, but it does. I didn't realize it has a distinct flavor profile separate from other waters. Again, I'd love to hear from you if you are a sparkling water drinker. What leads you to what brand over another? Why did you start drinking it? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. John in Burbank called in. He's under the perception that soda in and of itself, the carbonation harms teeth. I actually looked this up. According to the American Dental Association, that's not correct. Obviously, there are concerns about sugar and what that does to teeth, but carbonation per se, according to the ADA, is not a risk factor to teeth. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, and let us know. Norman Lakewood says there are differences in degrees of carbonation. It's another reason for having your own machine, because you can control that degree of carbonation. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Just to quickly update you on the story we're covering out of Washington, the confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, we're now hearing that Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee may be giving a private option to the accuser of Judge Kavanaugh, Professor Ford, that she may have an opportunity to speak in a closed session as opposed to a public hearing. Right now, President Trump is taking questions at the White House. The President of Poland is visiting at the White House. They just concluded their talk. And should there be any comments by the President about the Kavanaugh confirmation process, we will be bringing that to you right here on 89.3 KPCC. So let us know your thoughts about sparkling water. Caleb Bryan, as you look at this, which companies are sort of best poised to attract more drinkers of sparkling water?
Well, I think that we're seeing some sparkling water brands kind of really focus on their strengths or the differentiators. Think of Polar Sparkling Water. They've been doing some interesting things with flavors. Spindrift is a growing brand that might not fit into the typical sparkling water. It contains juice, so it has a bit maybe stronger flavor profile than something like LaCroix. Bubbly has a very unique packaging that is created by PepsiCo, so it has the marketing and the distribution strength of PepsiCo behind it. And even things like Topo Chico, which was acquired by Coca-Cola, kind of an older brand, has this air of authenticity and already kind of a established consumer base in Texas and other areas of the country. So I think that overall we're going to see more and more of these companies focusing on those differentiators, because to just be sparkling water, the market is getting kind of crowded right now. So you need to have that little differentiator.
Yeah. Damon and Marina Del Rey, good to have you with us. When did you get introduced to your particular brand of sparkling water?
Well, I was introduced to LaCroix in the 90s when I did a lot of business travel on United Airlines. And so when I could, I would schedule United Airlines instead of any other airline so I could get the water.
That's so funny, Damon. I love that. So you'd actually fly United to get it. So you couldn't go into a store at the time and buy it.
No, you couldn't. I'd never even heard of it. And you know, it was the regular plain or, you know, pure La Croix. So yeah, I didn't even know there were flavors until, you know, here in the 2000s.
That's great. So have you stayed loyal throughout all these years?
Oh, absolutely. I love it. And I've been converting people along the way.
So what is it for you? What's the big draw?
Well, the big draw on the pure, on the regular, was that it had a much better taste. It tasted like pure water. And then of course, it had bubbles. So it was, I love carbonated water. So.
But Perrier didn't do it for you, say, or Crystal Geyser or any of those others.
I love San Pellegrino. Those were probably my first real ones. And, you know, when I was in a bar, I would drink club soda if I didn't want to have a drink. So, yeah, I love bubbly water.
All right, Damon. So much so that he'd fly United to get his LaCroix. I want to thank our guest talking about the rise of seltzer water, sparkling water, Gary Hemphill, Beverage Marketing Corporation, Caleb Bryant, Mintel, Global Market Research Firm. Coming up on Air Talk, the Wild Woolly United States Football League, a spring alternative to the NFL. We had our own franchise. The LA Express with Steve Young at quarterback. We'll talk about the rise and fall of the USFL with Jeff Perlman, his book Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, there have been multiple attempts to try and take on the popular entertainment behemoth that's the National Football League. But perhaps the most colorful of all was the United States Football League back in the mid-1980s. It established franchises across the U.S. Rated talent, had some very prominent players, went on to have Hall of Fame careers later in the NFL. But the history of the USFL is highly entertaining, and that story is told in Jeff Perlman's new book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Jeff Perlman has written a number of books on the subject of sports, including The Bad Guys One, Boys Will Be Boys, and Showtime. Jeff, great to have you with us.
Thrilled to be here.
So the origins, I didn't realize the USFL's origins actually go back years before we ever even heard of it, to a guy in New Orleans.
Yeah, it was a guy named David Dixon, New Orleans art dealer, and he was very frustrated by the NFL's refusal to come to New Orleans. So he came up with this idea, spring football. What about spring football? And he ran it by Paul Brown, the founder of the Cleveland Browns and later the Bengals. And Paul Brown said, that's a great idea. You should do that. That's a great idea. Don't let that one go. And then the Saints came to New Orleans and he kind of let it go. And then in the 80s, it never totally left him. And he went to, he came out here to see George Allen, the former Redskins coach. And he said, what do you think of this idea? And George Allen said, that's a great idea. Don't let that go. You got to do that. And, you know, in the early 80s, he just kind of went after it and decided spring football is a viable alternative to the NFL.
And then how did it go from this idea into the actual introduction of the league and whole amassing the group of owners of the franchises?
Well, it was really – so this guy David Dixon and John Ralston, who had been a pretty legendary coach, went around – and started recruiting people and started recruiting guys with money. And he got people like Miles Tannenbaum and he got these Bill Daniels, who found, you know, cable TV executive. And he started getting these guys with big money. He convinced them to put down some loot. The idea was a really smart idea. That's the thing that gets lost. It was spring football. The drafts were going to be regional. So you're going to have a general draft. But then every team was going to have teams in their regional area that you could draft specifically from. So the LA Express would be drafting out of USC, UCLA. The Philadelphia Stars are taking Penn State and Pitt. The idea being fans who grew up watching these kids in high school, then in college, are going to be loyal to the team. They were going to limit the amount of money they spent. Each team would kind of go with maybe two big main players, then a lot of lesser name players. And we're just going to slow growth. And that was the idea. And people were really into it. So they had first season, they got 12 ownership groups. And there
and a national TV contract.
Well, they got to deal with two. They got to deal with ESPN, which at the time was a pretty young network, and the ABC. So unlike we were talking off the air about the World Football League, which came along, they never had a national TV deal. The USFL was very committed to getting a national TV deal.
And that's huge, obviously, because you've got, at the same time, the explosion of cable and the need for programming. And the USFL is sitting right there to do it.
Yeah. And if you look at the USFL, I think is interesting. It was the first league that was specifically created with TV in mind, where that we need a TV deal. We cannot survive without a TV deal. But even if you look at the uniforms, the helmets, they were very colorful, very explosive. You're talking about teams like the Gamblers and the Gunslingers with bright greens and champagne and sparkling red. They were really thinking about what is the audience going to see. And their first commissioner was Chet Simmons, who was a head of ESPN, and he came to run the USFL. So it was a very TV-oriented.
Yeah, league. It really gave him credibility, I recall, right out of the bat. And then the New Jersey Generals had a very interesting ownership situation.
Well, in 1983, they were all owned by a guy named J. Walter Duncan, who was an Oklahoma oil man. And the original owner of the New Jersey Generals was supposed to be some guy you may have heard of named Donald Trump. And at the time, he was an obscure businessman in New York, and he agreed to be the New York owner. And they have one of the early owner meetings before the league is started in a San Francisco suite. And they're waiting for this guy, Donald Trump, to show up. They're waiting and they're waiting. And finally, the phone rings and they put it on speaker. Hey, guys, it's Donald. So I got some bad news. I think I'm not going to be doing this. I got some big stuff going on, really big stuff. So I'm sorry. I hope it all goes well. Click. The room is just dead silent. Like, what the hell just happened here? We just lost our New York owner. And they got this Oklahoma oil man, Walter Duncan, to take one for the team, basically. And he owned the team for a year. They signed Herschel Walker. And at the end of that year, Walter Duncan decided Oklahoma was a little far from New York. And he decided to sell. And the guy who bought the team was Donald Trump. Yeah, Walter Duncan was looking for $8 million, and Donald Trump offered $10.5 million.
Now, fast forward, you come, what is it, about a year later, and Trump has an idea for how he wants the league to change its schedule.
Well, he wants to go fall. And there are a lot of interesting things about this. So I pitched this book way before Trump was a presidential candidate, just to be clear.
You don't need him for it to be a great story.
No, I don't. I guess he helps in sales in a way. I mean, you know, but it's not like I thought of him as the USFL. He buys a team, and in the lead up to buying the team, all he does is talk about spring football and how great it is. I love this league. I love everything about it. He buys a team. He does a complete 180. We need to move to fall. We need to take the NFL on directly. And he has a secret meeting that he arranges with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, at the Pierre Hotel in New York City in a suite that Donald Trump paid for. And he says to Rozelle, I don't care about the USFL. The USFL doesn't mean anything to me. I want to get into the NFL. What do I need to do? And Pete Rozelle said to him very bluntly, as long as I'm involved in the NFL, as long as my heirs are involved in the NFL, you will never have a team in this league.
Wow.
He just didn't trust him. He just didn't trust him. Trump, one of his strengths, he keeps charging. He was undeterred. He decided this league needs to move to fall and force a merger with the NFL. That was the one way he was going to get it. He starts undermining the commissioner, Chet Simmons. He's talking with the networks on his own. They're all telling him, we don't want to give you a fall TV deal. He goes back to the other owners and says, they want to give us a fall TV deal. It's great. I mean, he literally lies about a fall TV deal. Just being honest, he lies about it. He makes it up. And he was in a very strong position of power because the other marquee franchises, Washington, Chicago, LA, all were struggling. They needed New York contractually with ABC and ESPN. They needed New York.
I don't know if the Express was playing at Pierce College in Woodland Hills by that
point. Wow, nice.
But that was where they ended up playing their final games.
Final game, Pierce College. They had to drag in stands to fill it. It was Steve Young and Doug Williams as the quarterbacks in that last game.
Wow.
Pierce College. On the bus ride to that game, I just want to say, the bus driver for the LA Express, they were down to about 28 guys because they weren't replacing guys because of injuries. The bus driver pulls the bus over and says, I ain't driving until I get my $500. And they literally pass a hat around. And one of the employees goes out and somehow gets the money. But otherwise, he was not going to drive to the game.
Amazing. Because by that point, no bills were being paid, presumably.
Yeah.
We're talking with Jeff Perlman, his new book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. If you remember that league of 30 years ago in the LA Express, or you're living in another city and following the USFL franchise there, share with us your memories of the league. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. What I was talking talking with A. Martinez of Take Two, and we were doing our crosstalk before Air Talk today. A was so excited remembering the USFL. He was a big Express fan. So if you're in that category, we'd love to hear from you. 866-893-KPCC. Your book is full of so many wild stories of transportation. And I love the old ABA stories because they're incredible American Basketball Association stories. USFL has more than its share, too.
Oh, yeah.
Just share with us one of your favorites before we break.
Yeah, my favorite is there was a player on the LA Express named Greg Fields. He had been in camp with the Atlanta Falcons, and they cut him, and he refused to leave. So they had to get an armed security guard to get him out.
Yeah, he barricaded himself in his room. Yeah.
He signs with the LA Express. John Hadle is the coach of the LA Express. And John Hadle, 1984, John Hadle decides he's going to cut Greg Fields. And his assistants are like, you just want to be careful with this guy. Nah, it'll be fine. What's the worst thing going to happen? Calls Greg Fields in. Greg, I'm really sorry. It's been great having you here. Pop. Greg Fields punches him in the face. People come rushing in. They're pulling him out. Greg Fields says, I'm going to kill you. He starts calling in death threats to the team.
After he's let go.
And they hire Liberace's bodyguard, Nelson Mercado, away from Liberace to protect the coach from Greg Fields, who's showing up at games with a gun in his trunk. Here's the craziness about the USFL. Everyone knows about this. This is well-documented, Greg Fields. The San Antonio Gunslingers need pass rush help.
Oh, well, perfect. The Gunslingers.
So they signed Greg Fields. They stop paying their players. Greg Fields follows the owner of the Gunslingers home with a baseball bat in his trunk, says, you're going to pay me. The owner, Clint Mangus, goes into his house, comes back out with $17,000 in cash, gives it to Greg Fields, says, are we good? Greg Fields is like, yeah, we're good, and drives off.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of the great stories that are included in Jeff Perlman's Football for a Buck. We'll continue in just a minute. More stories of the United States Football League here on Air Talk. I don't know what it is about marginal sports leagues with great stories, but it's sure true for the old ABA. The World Hockey League had great stories. And the USFL, which was around for a couple of years in the mid-80s, including the LA Express franchise, has more than its share of very colorful and very funny stories. They're told in Jeff Perlman's new book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. At what point did the league's financial shortcomings start really showing themselves?
Probably at the end of the first season, they made one of the dumbest moves in pro sports history. They had 12 teams. They had a fairly okay first season. And then they expanded by six teams because they thought each team was going to have to pay $6 million. So it was a quick cash grab. So when they expanded, and when they expanded into markets like San Antonio and Tulsa, it was kind of a bad sign. It was like a sign of desperation. And that's when it really turned sort of
dark. Because at that time, San Antonio, there was no Alamo Dome yet, was there in San Antonio?
No, and they ended up playing in Alamo Stadium. It's the best thing. They played on a – the owner of the San Antonio Gunslingers was so cheap, he used industrial spray paint to spray the field.
Mm-hmm.
So players would slide on this cheap AstroTurf, and they would get these big burns up and down their arms, and the paint would get in the burns. So you'd have this industrial crust paint mixing with burns, as you'd and they were just cheap beyond cheap.
Dan in Arcadia says, I'm from New Jersey. I was so excited about the Generals. Went to a couple of games. I remember the major players. They should have stayed in the spring. I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah.
That's Dan in Arcadia. Could the league have survived had it not moved to the fall?
I think it would have survived for a while. I think ultimately you would have had a merger. I really do. The league ended. Its last season was 1985. 1987, the NFL had a massive player strike where they started using the replacement players. A lot of people at the USFL look at that and think, if we were around then, it's mass anarchy in pro football, and players are going left and right. The NFL panics. You have to remember, you had a team in Jacksonville before the NFL did. You had a team in Tennessee before the NFL did. You had a team in Baltimore when the Colts were gone. You had a team in Oakland, the Raiders were gone. You had a team in Birmingham that was drawing really well. There were a lot of markets. And even Donald Trump's idea was that the Jets had just moved to Jersey, was that he would get a Manhattan team. They would move to Jersey and move to Manhattan. It was not a crazy idea. It actually was not a crazy
idea. Did he have a stadium plan, though?
Yeah, he thought the city was going to build him a stadium. And they might have. Because there have been years and years where Manhattan had been talking about building a stadium. that he had queens that he could have gone to immediately, Shay, until that happened. It wasn't a crazy idea. It was just horribly executed.
So you think had they survived a bit longer, the NFL might have absorbed some of those, mm-hmm. Like the Tennessee franchise or Baltimore or some of these others, which is what happened with the predecessor leagues in other sports.
Yeah.
The major leagues absorbed them. Do you think that it was the move to the fall that was really the central issue that killed it earlier?
I do. I mean, I think the owners spent too much money. They spent beyond their means. The move to fall was a suicide mission. I mean, think of it this way. You have a team in Houston. Well, you move to fall, the NFL has a team in Houston playing in the same stadium. You have a team in Michigan. You have another team playing in Detroit, too. What are you going to do? It made no sense whatsoever. It was a suicide mission in football. It made no sense whatsoever. And everyone knew it back then. That's a weird thing about it.
We have Aaron in Fountain Valley said, I used to work in the USFL for Bruce and George Allen. Great, kindest people to work with. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You want to say something, Jeff?
Well, Bruce Allen, he just mentioned Bruce Allen.
Yeah.
So the Chicago Blitz were the first team in the USFL to try out players. And they auditioned more than 3,000 players. They went all over and would try out everybody. And one of my favorite stories of all time is they had this system, like at Soldier Field, they would hold workouts. And they try out hundreds of players, and maybe four would be signed, and they'd come to a future minicamp. And if you were signed, you'd go up into the stands, and Bruce Allen, the general manager, would be waiting there, and he'd sign you to a contract. There's this one guy who tried out. His name was Albert C. Lynch. He was a 5'8" linebacker who'd never played football on any level, and he stunk. He was terrible. But he's watching all these guys go up into the stands. So Albert C. Lynch does his workout and goes up into the stands. And he signs a contract. And later on, Bruce Allen meets with the coaches. And the coaches are like, why did you sign Albert C. Lynch? And he's like, well, you send me Albert C. Lynch. And they're like, we didn't send you Albert C. Lynch. And all of a sudden, they have this light bulb moment of pure joy. And they still, 30 years later, but independent of each other, brought up to me, oh, yeah, someone's got to tell you about Albert C. Lynch. And I was like, I know about Albert C. Lynch. He's the best.
What a great story. Jeff, alcohol, cocaine, sex. I mean, it's a big part of this era. And I guess not surprisingly, where the USFL doesn't have quite the same profile, the NFL, that players in heavily indulge. It reminded me like the Oakland Raiders on a league-wide basis.
Well, I mean, the Washington Federals probably led the league in cocaine and ineptitude. And that could have been their slogan, Washington Federals, cocaine and ineptitude. Their quarterback was Joe Gilliam for a while. Joe Gilliam, yeah, who had been the Pittsburgh Steeler. By the time he came to Washington, he was a really struggling drug addict. He's picked up at the airport to be brought to his press conference by the 24-year-old PR guy, Rick Vaughn. First thing Joe Gilliam says is, can we stop at a store? I want to get a beer. So he's a drug addict, and he's drinking a beer out of a paper bag as they drive to the press conference. During his time in Washington, he lived in two places, the front seat of his Oldsmobile and a halfway house for reformed drug addicts. Those were the starting quarterback for the Washington Federals homes.
Wow.
Another player in the Washington Federals was this guy, Doug Green. He was a safety. And before being a member of the Washington Federals, he was Rick James's bodyguard. So he worked as a bodyguard.
So he was exposed to a lot.
He told me some stories.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
All right. Jeff Perlman, Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL and other aspects of the libertine life of USFL play. Wasn't there one team where there was like a sort of hookers that were provided regularly?
That's so funny. The Portland Breakers, who originally were the Boston Breakers, but then the New Orleans Breakers. So they played in three cities in 3 years. The beauty being they were all by water. So they could always
breakers,
be the Breakers.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the Utah Jazz. Where you can't
or
find
the
jazz
LA Lakers.
Right, or the LA Lakers. They arrive in Portland, Oregon, and they show up for their first event, and they are greeted by a line of prostitutes all holding business cards. And the PR manager is like, I didn't even know hookers had business cards. That was just lying to me that I just loved. Hookers have business cards? There's a guy on the Houston Gamblers named Richard Johnson, a wide receiver, a really good player. And he used to smoke a joint before every game. And there was another guy on the team named Vince Corville who never used drugs. And he was not as good a player. And he watched Richard Johnson smoking joints and he thought, it works for him.
That's
I'm going to try
secret.
It. So before a game, he smokes one of Richard Johnson's especially powerful joints. And he runs onto the field and he's just overcome by complete fear and paranoia why is everyone looking at me? What's going on with my head? He had the worst game of his life, never smoked joint again.
Great anecdote to close it off on. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Very entertaining, fascinating book. Thank you.
So much.
Jeff Perlman, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. From all of us at Air Talk, have a terrific afternoon. He'll be talking about his book, by the way, Chevalier's Books, Larchmont Village, Thursday at 7 p.m.